This is the 11th of February, 2015, Hung Cheng being interviewed by Derek Hockaday. Hung, I guess that the first time you came to Oxford in connection with ophthalmology would be one of the conferences.
That's right, yes.
When would that have been, roughly?
Oh, I first came, I think, in 1967 or 8. To the Oxford Congress, which, as you know, is an annual international congress mm-hmm. held at that time in Balliol. And the, although it was started by Doyne, Robert Doyne, who was the founder of the eye hospital, the Oxford Eye Hospital actually had very little to do with the congress, other than from time to time the people who worked there participated. But it was a very lively meeting because the location of Oxford was so attractive in the summer for an international meeting. We had people from the three continents, you know, from all the continents. So I first got to came to Oxford for that reason.
Who would be chairing the conference?
Well, the conference has a master, and this rotates every 2 years.
Right.
So usually somebody eminent is elected into the mastership. But there is a committee that runs the program. And these are the committee can usually consists of both regional and academic representatives. So in other words, there would be people interested in the front of the eye, the back of the eye, people from Ireland, from Scotland. So, and so it's sort of fairly representative of a national body that is sort of reputable, representative. And it's very, very good. And of course, because of the, at that time, it was limited to only senior registrars and consultants. It was much later on when we found a bigger venue mm-hmm. that we made it into an open meeting. At that time, we met in the physiology school.
Right.
You see how small that was.
Yes.
And I first came because I wanted to present a case at, of diabetic maculopathy, which I treated by xenon arc and got the certain exudates to disappear. I mean, there was no comment on the vision, but it just this cause, and that was a step forward, so to speak. And that's my first acquaintanceship with Oxford.
You were just telling me about xenon arc,
yeah.
retinal photocoagulation, and was the Hammersmith or Moorfields the first place to do it in England?
Moorfields was the first place to do it, because Hammersmith had a big diabetic clinic, and they were doing innovative research to do with the treatment of sight-threatening retinopathy. It was natural that Moorfields, which is aiming to introduce this treatment, should be liaised with that. And this is how I got involved, really, because as I was saying to you, I mean, as you know well, at that time, diabetic retinopathy was the commonest cause of blindness. So I was motivated to get involved with looking into that and see whether xenon arc photocoagulation was what it claimed to be. A professor in Germany called Meyer Schickerath, he was a retinal surgeon, and he invented this treatment partly to try and weld the retina back onto the choroid, onto the underlying coat, because initially, before the retina becomes completely detached, you have a tear, and that was a time when you actually could put weld it back on before the fluid separates the retina from the choroid, and then it wouldn't have any effect. And because this is a welding process, in other words, you produce heat, coagulate tissue, he also applied it to retinopathy.
Mm-hmm.
And he claimed in his little booklet about the use of light xenon arc photocoagulation that this was also effective in the treatment of diabetic retinopathy. So up and down the country and in different parts of the world, people bought this gigantic machine, which is called a jumbo, because it had to house this mechanism to generate an intense xenon arc, which is then reflected by mirrors onto an ophthalmoscope. Well, when we actually applied this treatment, it wasn't really that as successful as he implied in this book. But nevertheless, it had some, I mean, like all treatment, which sometimes was effective and sometimes not, there was a lot of doubt. It was natural that it was a sort of prelude to a randomized controlled trial.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what was started in London, spearheaded by the group in London between Morpheus and Hammersmith.
So you and Eva?
Yes, you. I was the one of the active members who went around the country trying to drum up
right.
interest, and I did some of the treatment in Morpheus. Well, I did most of the treatment in Morpheus. But it was actually very difficult to get people to really put their back into it. So essentially it became mostly Morpheus and with the input patient from the Hammersmith. A handful of cases from other places like Bristol, one or two from Ireland. But and this accounted for the small numbers. So we are dealing with hundreds of patients as opposed to thousands that we hoped to have got. And that would have brought the trial to an earlier, to have brought some conclusive results earlier.
So when did it change to argon?
To argon. Well, that was really when the United States... I mean, argon was introduced earlier on
right.
by different people, and I've forgotten the name of the person who mostly initiated in the United States. It seemed a much more wieldy way, and mm-hmm. also you could generate more power, so to speak. So the American multi-center randomized controlled trial was based on argon, whereas we started earlier, and we had only the xenon, which was a sort of tool that most people possess in the UK. And it was so our study was based on xenon arc photocoagulation, whereas the American was based on argon laser photocoagulation. As I was saying to you, these were exciting times because it seemed that this ravaging disease was could be brought under control. And in fact, we published the first paper in the UK, as you know. I can't remember the day. I think it was 76 in the Lancet when we published the result to say that it was effective in the treatment of maculopathy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we didn't have enough cases to analyze subgroups in the way the Americans did, but overall there was a statistically significant difference between the treated and untreated groups.
And is that for vision or for
vision.
Retinal appearance?
For vision.
Yeah.
And this is obviously important because this is maculopathy is essentially to do with the macula and vision, of course, is a prime indicator of function. A year later, the Americans published a bigger study, and they show that it was also effective in mm-hmm. retinopathy. Well, we then published another paper a year later supporting it, but with smaller numbers. So, you know, I was very lucky to be involved in such a study and you know, to reach positive results, as it were.
Was there photocoagulation in Oxford before you came here?
Yes, photocoagulation, there was a jumbo.
Mm-hmm.
A xenon arm. But as far as I could tell, some patients were treated, but there wasn't a really organized effort mm-hmm. to tackle retinopathy. And when I came, already there was a portable xenon, which was much easier to use.
Mm-hmm.
We acquired that, and then very shortly afterwards, the Argon became available, and it was then we used that, we converted to that.
What made you decide to come to Oxford? I mean, there you were in London, notable bloke, you know, doing well.
Well, I was attracted to London, to Oxford for a number of reasons, because Oxford's a very nice place, and a lot going on. And to tell you the truth, the person who's my sort of immediate boss didn't really want me as on his unit as a permanent colleague.
In Moorfields.
And he had his eye on another fellow, so mm-hmm. I really need to find another job.
Now, were you a consultant in Tunbridge Wells?
Yes.
While you were working at Moorfields?
Yes.
Yes, I understand. Yes.
This is how I had to, you know, in case I didn't. As you know, when you become a senior registrar, there's a sort of pressure for you to go. And I could have gone. I mean, I could have applied to the London. In fact, I did apply to the London, and I was hot favourite, according to one of the people who was on the board of selection.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't like the senior surgeon, a chap called Barry Jay, he's dead now. And he was not a very nice person to be working with. And thinking about it, you know, to spend my next 30 years, 35 years, or 25 years with him was mm-hmm. unthinkable. And of course, there's a very nice unit here headed by Tony Bronn, mm-hmm. who was very innovative and active. And so I thought, well, it would be very nice to collaborate with Tony Bronn,
mm-hmm.
Particularly at a time when he actually had a grant from the Wellcome Wellcome Trust.
To do what?
To see if the improved glucose control
mm-hmm.
had a beneficial effect on retinopathy.
Yes.
Yeah. As you know, the methods for controlling diabetes wasn't refined enough,
no.
So therefore you couldn't tell. So anyway, but I contributed to that, and of course the other thing is, I was lucky in another respect that lens implantation mm. was the beginning, and I did some early work when I was in London at Tunbridge Wells, and I, because of my work with the randomized controlled trial on diabetic retinopathy, the head of the NIH, I gave a paper in the United States, and one of his associates got hold of me and said, look, why don't you do a randomized controlled trial on lens implantation?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to design that, and I thought, well, if I could come to Oxford, I would be able to find collaborators. If I was, you know, elsewhere in a provincial hospital, I couldn't possibly attract young talent, you know, people who could assist me in research. And indeed, I did get a big grant from the NIH to do this, and we, you know, published some papers. Out of there, we had we had this grant for 5-6 years or longer, so when I came to Oxford, I introduced lens implantation, which then subsequently took off in a big way because it was the natural way to go. And didn't need a randomized controlled trial. But the randomized controlled trial did throw up some methodological formulae or ways in which they actually subsequently employ to do other studies, notably one in India, where they're trying to, the NIH funded a big study in India trying to compare lens implantation with other forms of treatment to see whether it was A, safe, whether it was cost effective. So it wasn't completely wasted. And it was something that had to be done, a randomized controlled trial.
And then Tony in the Institute had people working on the biochemistry of the lens, didn't he?
Yes,
and cataract formation.
Yes, yes,
and did you get involved with that at all?
Well, I didn't, other than as a, there was one paper I think I contributed to it.
But you provided some lenses.
Oh, yes. Method of lens implantation evolved in such a way that they actually lost a lot of material, because initially when one did cataract surgery, one removed the whole lens, and then we sent the lens to the lab and they looked at the biochemistry, looked at the biophysics. But when we discover that the best way to retain the implant in the space where the lens should be was not to remove the whole lens, but to remove the contents of the lens, but retain the capsule so that the artificial lens goes into the capsule, then they lost the material. Yeah. So, but I mean, not altogether. There was still some. And then later on, the cataract surgery improved the technical aspects, and I introduced phacoemulsification, which greatly simplified the way cataract was removed. So, I mean, this in a way rounds up the way I was saying to you that I was involved, lucky to be involved in a time of a lot of innovation, important innovation.
And that was by ultrasound, was it?
Phacoemulsification was introduced by a man called Kelman, who's a rather charismatic figure, who played saxophone in New York in a nightclub in the nighttime, and then did some ophthalmology in the daytime. But he had the vision to persuade an engineer to make a ultrasonic probe, which you could then introduce into the lens space and fragment the lens. And then you evacuate the lenticular material as a liquid. So thus, you could then preserve the... I mean, obviously, like all innovative surgery, it had its problems initially, but then it became a kind of an adopted method, which not only revolutionized cataract surgery, but and enabled people to have cataract surgery much earlier on, so they weren't so disabled. But it made it a much faster operation, which meant that in a few minutes you could, and the patient didn't have to rest for so long afterwards.
No. Did anybody work out, or from your memories, how many people got leg vein thrombosis or pulmonary emboli after cataract surgery?
Well, in my time already, people were mobilized fairly early
on. Okay.
It was only in the very early days, before I started ophthalmology, that they put sandbags on both sides of the head, and they, as you said quite rightly, they would suffer these other systemic complications.
Yes. Yeah. And, I mean, obviously you were doing general ophthalmological practice and the lens work.
Yes.
But Tell me, actually, because I came to wonder, because you came to Oxford as a real diabetic pundit, but yeah. What year was that you came?
I came in 77.
Yes. You see, 76, we just started a prospective Oxford study,
yes,
looking at control against
yes,
tissue damage,
yes,
and linked up with Philip Audrey, because yes, before you came, yes, he was the guy yeah, most interested. Yeah. And then, of course, a bit later, Rob Turner got his UKPDS
yes,
going.
Right,
so did you get involved with the UKPDS?
I did get involved. I helped the MSc, the fellow,
mm-hmm,
Wellcome Fellow, although I never got acknowledged.
Well, I thought not.
I never got acknowledged, yeah, but on the other hand, I'd helped him. I gave him a lot of help, and... And also I did some of the initial assessment for Robert Turner.
Right.
But you know how it is. It didn't matter to me in those days anymore because, I mean, well, I had other interests.
Yes. Now, Howard Williams, was it Juliet Howard Williams?
Yes.
You see, she did a lot of work on our retinopathy, presumably
yes,
with Philip Audrey.
Yes.
But she didn't work with you.
No, she didn't.
I understand. No. So you would have your own little team, and Philip would have his little team.
That's
right,
yeah, yeah.
Yes.
No, Philip, he continued to give the medical school a lecture on diabetic retinopathy to the medical students. But I don't think he was involved with the research. When Robert Turner had his study, when he got go initially,
mm-hmm,
he sent all his patients for me to assess an annual eye check. But then as the study grew, I couldn't possibly accommodate in my...
From everywhere else,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So he had to appoint other people.
Well, he did it with Eva, didn't he? Or probably several other people.
No, he did it with other people, but I think the retinopathy was... I can't remember. Well, I mean, of course, when the fellow was here, he did it.
Right.
Eva
was the sort of national speaker, as you can imagine,
yes, yes,
on the UKPDS
yes,
retinopathy.
Yes.
Right. And did you eventually come to give the lecture on diabetic retinopathy?
Well, that's a long story. I did give lectures on diabetic retinopathy, and I was flattered that... The professor in Glasgow, whenever he wrote about retinopathy, he always quoted the very first paper that I gave to do with the efficacy of treating maculopathy. I tell you a story which will amuse you. When you asked me to give the retinopathy lecture to your course, you said, "Oh, we got double projection."
Mm.
So, stupidly on my part, I didn't check that you had double projection like we are used to.
Right.
So, I got two carousels. I prepared the lecture. Two carousels arrive at your theatre only to find that you got one projector and the other one you did by hand.
Right, I
and
see.
I had some blanks. But because you were down there and I was up there, I couldn't communicate with you effectively. I said, "Look, there's some blanks." So the whole thing was a fiasco.
Oh dear. Because I sort of remember that.
That was
I'm
a sad
sorry.
History. But,
yes.
It was my fault. I should have.
No,
rubbish. Ever since I've checked,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. But you gave it again at another course.
Well, I have given lectures.
Yes, I'm sure you have, yes.
Yeah.
And now, when you came, I mean, the eye hospital is a small place, small
yeah,
building,
yeah,
and there was the institute behind
yes,
it.
Yes.
I mean, what changes did you see in the actual eye hospital while you were in Oxford?
Well, huge changes, because when I first arrived, we had this operating theatre with a tiny space adjacent for the anaesthetist to give anaesthetics. And from many points of view, from you know, strictly hygiene point of view, it wasn't really the ideal solution. But we continued to work there until we could move to the tower block. There's another funny story which I'm going to tell you because when I first arrived, Tom Patterson was still the plastic surgeon, and he said to me, "Oh yes, I know the eye hospital because I used to work with Purvis." And when I was operating with him one day, I heard a pitter-patter. I looked round, there was a matron bringing her little dog to see how we were getting on. Well, things had changed from then. And when we moved to the tower block, then we did everything the same. As the I can't remember what date it was, but we did away with, and then of course the other thing was we modified because numbers grew and we did many more things in the eye hospital, so we had to introduce more consulting space, and we obviously made use of the theater, the part of the theater which we convert into the casualty department, and so on. So things sort of gradually improved.
They built a corridor too, didn't they, linking you to a bit
to the
main building.
To the main building.
Yes, because I can remember that arriving, which made it much easier to get to the eye hospital,
particularly to the lecture theatre.
And. So you were teaching, obviously, clinical students. How did you find that?
Yes, we were teaching clinical students. Well, the time that they were allowed, they were exposed to ophthalmology was very short. So they used to come to my clinic, and then I would show them cases. So this sort of hands-on teaching, methods of examination, some of the clinical material they saw. As far as I can tell, not all the students came. I mean, I think it was sort of, you know, far left to those who had an interest, those who had other things to do. So there's a handful of them rotated through the clinic. There nearly always is somebody in the clinic. So this is how ophthalmology was taught.
And then you had house visit surgeons.
We had house surgeons, and the team expanded when I first came. There was just one senior registrar, with the diabetic retinopathy work, a second man was appointed to work with me with a particular emphasis on helping with the load of diabetic retinopathy. And then also on the junior staff, we had more SHOs. And also we had some clinical assistants, because one of the nice things was that Rosemary Rue introduced a part-time training scheme for married women, and we benefited by having at least three in my time, you know, who went through the rotation, and others came. So we the team, the junior staff, expanded a bit, and because of the sort of things that was going on in the lab, Tony's lab, and also in the clinical field, we attracted some very good students. For example, I can quote the Julian Stevens, who was supposed to be the top, past top of the his year. He became an ophthalmologist. I had a chap, Keith Bates, who was a scholar of Oreo, I think, or Corpus, I can't remember. They all had either first or extremely well qualified. There were several of these people. So for a time, Oxford
Do you want to answer that?
Can I?
Yeah, of course.
Excuse me, it's fine.
Cool.
We had some very good people who's been through, and as a matter of fact, the present professor, Robert McLaren, he went through our training program.
Very nice.
And he's extremely innovative, and you may have seen him on television. The first person to put a microchip behind the retina to simulate a sort of vision.
Oh yes, I've heard of that.
Totally blind, and he's got other. He's got lots of grants, and so the professorial unit is very active.
So that's Tony Brown's readership made into a chair.
It's a personal chair. As far as I can see, it is a personal chair, but I think he has the readership, Margaret Ogilvie readership. But he's working in the umbrella of neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
The professor of the neuroscience department is Russell Foster.
Yes.
You may have heard him. Probably in Brasenose.
Yes, correct.
Yes. So Robert McLaren has continued propagate the name of Oxford after Tony Brown, so that the research part is alive and well.
Yes.
They got stem cells, gene therapy, all that sort of thing going on.
The move up the hill would be after your time.
After my time.
And has the laboratory gone up there? Has it with the institute?
Yes.
It's partly into neuroscience as
partly
well.
Partly into neuroscience. Yes.
Yes.
I don't know whether the integration is. I haven't really looked into it closely. I did go to one of their seminars, and I was very impressed by what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed to be working well.
Yes. And, when you came, my guess is the facilities were all at least a bit more cramped than Moorfields. But when you went into the tower block, was that everything you wanted, or...?
The tower block, the operating theatres were more modern.
Mm-hmm.
And... as you know, I also worked with Mike Poole in the craniofacial unit.
Mm-hmm.
So it was much more convenient. There were cases where I operated with him, and there were also cases where he came to us. And that wouldn't have been possible if he didn't go into the tower block.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, the changing room was left a lot to be desired.
Right. Okay.
But I hope things are better than they were. But
so the eye hospital hadn't had anything to do with the design of it.
No.
That's a shame.
No.
Isn't it? Yes.
No. That was the craniofacial unit was also something which was. A very interesting development in the rank of infirmary, and the eye, ophthalmology was very glad to be involved, because as you know, some of these gross deformities like APETs and Crouzons were attempting to try and correct to some extent their deformity.
Yes. Is it accidents, or was it mostly deformity, congenital deformity?
Mostly congenital deformity.
Right.
That the craniofacial unit is dealing with. Mike Poole was the chief prime mover in that unit.
Now, obviously, a surgeon depends on a lot of people. How did you find the standard of nursing?
Well, the standard of nursing was very good, I must say, because when I first came, there were some sisters who were of the old school,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think if you were a nurse there, you'd get away with being sloppy. So they set very good examples. The outpatient sister was a big lady, and there could be no nonsense with her. Now I think that was and of course gradually things change, sometimes for the worse, but I'm glad to see that they're changed back to, for example, they discarded the uniform, see?
Yeah.
And I thought that was a retrograde step, mm-hmm. because A, patients didn't know who they were, and also you wonder about, you know, on theoretical grounds, it can't be, the cleanliness part mm-hmm. is questionable, see? Mm-hmm. So all those things. I don't know what else.
Well, when you first came, did you have a nominated number of beds, or was it all fused, as it were?
Oh, it was all fused.
Yes, good.
It was all fused. But of course, the eye hospital being separate,
mm-hmm.
the eye beds were largely protected.
Yes.
So that we weren't always looking over the shoulder to see whether medicine might have pinched. the bed, so.
But did you even have a ward with, say, one other consultant, or was it a complete?
There were two wards, a male ward and a female ward,
yes.
And there was one room, which was supposed to be isolation ward or private.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can remember, there were nearly always enough beds for the people who were on the waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
Because more often than not, we have some long cases like a retinal detachment. So it's limited by the duration of the list.
Mm-hmm.
For the duration of the list, we nearly always had beds available.
I mean, do you remember roughly how long would have been the waiting time for, say, cataract back then?
There was a time when it was, maybe I think, not something I can vouch for.
No.
But I think a year, up to a year.
Yes.
So that was a very long wait, but I...
Would there be any other condition with as long a wait as that?
Well, if you had glaucoma, you wouldn't have to wait long. If you had detachment, you wouldn't have to wait.
Yeah.
These are sort of detachment was more or less an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Glaucomas would have priority because you know it wouldn't do. So if you were you'd left it. So cataract was, because it's a non-urgent operation, mm-hmm. and the progression of cataract is by and large slow. But the thing that perhaps the group that was disadvantaged a little bit was the squints, mm-hmm. children with squints, mm-hmm. because of the waiting time. And I think the waiting time was largely limited by the time available, but also by the sessions, the number of sessions we had.
Mm-hmm.
The ophthalmologist didn't have enough sessions so that we could actually have a much bigger turnover.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was my recollection.
So that's sessions in the tower block as opposed to your own surgery? Your own
even before.
Right,
even before. Okay. Because it was... sort of linked to the anaesthetic, because there's just one room available for the operating for three years, for four consultants.
Now anaesthetists, they're important, and how did you find that? And I suppose it became quite a lot of it became local.
Yes, yes, progressively. Mm-hmm. I operate ophthalmic surgery, relying less on general anesthesia. And this was became kind of more or less universal. I think there are long operations like a vitrectomy,
mm-hmm.
Or a complicated retinal detachment, well, they change much later. But for nearly all the other surgery, apart from dacryocysteroidostomy, you change over the local. But then, because of the age of the patients, we still needed an anaesthetist. So, although particularly for cataract surgery, because many of the patients are old, we still needed an anaesthetist to be available mm-hmm. in case of a sort of yes. emergency, like respiratory distress or some heart problem. So,
and then there's local anaesthetic, you know, dropping stuff into the eye.
Yes.
And then there are things of injecting. Yes. And numb. Well, and anaesthetists do that, presumably. Do they? Or did you?
Well,
do that?
In our time, we still use retrobulbar or peribulbar mm-hmm. anaesthesia, and you inject it around the eyeball.
So you injected.
We did. Yes. Because on the whole, we were more used to doing that, and the anaesthetists, although they're trained to give local anaesthetics, they're not trained, they'd be less expert in doing that. So we prefer that we take the risk rather to let
them. No, I understand.
But now cataract surgery has evolved so much that more often than not, they only use topical anaesthesia, in other words, some cocaine or some short-acting anaesthetic drops.
And when you arrived, how did anaesthesiology compare with London?
I thought it was much the same, really. Yes, okay. If anything, I think the anaesthetists were more sort of, compared to Moorfields, notably, we had quite senior people, but it seemed rather old-fashioned. Compared to Oxford, it was more, more sort of progressive.
Of course, the School of Anaesthetics is famous from Nuffield's time.
Yes, of course.
You know, they've had a professor. Then how much do you work with pathologists? I mean, how important is that?
Not so much, because we didn't do so much tumour work.
Right. I mean, melanomas, would you do them? Or?
Melanomas, of course, local excision. Of basal cell carcinomas. But I personally didn't get a lot of tumour work passed my way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the tendency was referring the melanomas to plastic surgeon because require bigger excision and also some reconstruction quite often.
And then bacteriologists, do you work with them?
Very much, yes. Mm-hmm. Because the one disaster, the one complication we fear after cataract surgery or any intraocular surgery is enophthalmitis.
Yeah.
And we critically depend on working closely with them when we have a case, which I'm happy to say happened rarely, but when we did, it was very critical that we liaise with them closely about type, what sort of the sensitivity, the type of bacteria, and sensitivity, likely sensitivity, and so on. You know.
When were you busiest in your professional career? Would you say, as a consultant or previously, or?
I would say that as a consultant, because as you know, one is given so many sessions, and to try and write papers, it has to be done in your spare time. And it's a question of creating sort of working myself up to have energy, and then creating the time, you know, to do things and also to write up. And so I would say that the middle period, when I was particularly when I was traveling, going to report to the NIH, that was the sort of most demanding period, because you know you go there because you're trying to get things ready and get a paper ready to go. Then you suffer from jet lag when you get there, and you come back, you suffer from jet lag again, and you try and catch up.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't easiest of times. But it's actually salutary, because I don't need to say it to you.
Did you do outpatients outside Oxford?
I did Banbury.
Mm-hmm.
Once a week, every Friday morning.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a big rush, you know, it's a service one had to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always a rush trying to get back to the afternoon activity in Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
It was when I was so, I had such a long waiting time for people to get to my clinic, that I once said to the, my colleague Arnold Feeman weren't getting many referrals. And I discovered that from our clinical assistant that he's thinking of actually cutting down his clinics. So I wrote to the medical council committee to say, look, for heaven's sake, don't let him, because you should write to the GP not to ask him to send me so many patients, send more to him, because you know the waiting time to get to my clinic is over long, and you know I invariably Fridays is a day I don't have any lunch because of the rush. So apparently this was a bit of a joke, because Robert Bell, the pediatrician, he's sort of very extrovert, loquacious. He said, oh, I see you. Okay, was, yeah, the man who never has any lunch.
But at Banbury, were you just doing outpatients, or were you operating?
No, I wasn't doing outpatients, because it was a Calaisian I would do it, but there wasn't the facility, and the pressure of the clinic was too great. There were too many patients, and you couldn't stop there to operate.
So they'd come to Oxford.
Oxford, yes. And I think, and of course, the other thing is that ophthalmic equipment, when it comes to things like lasers and so on, it's so expensive.
Yes,
you couldn't really put them in all the outpatient places like Whitney, Banbury.
Stoke Mandeville, were they the second to get one?
Stoke Mandeville, in the region, it was Windsor.
Right.
Windsor had a very active chap called Jack Kansky.
Mm-hmm.
And he would manage to get a lot of equipment.
And were you involved in, as it were, educating him, or did he come from elsewhere?
No, he was a contemporary of mine, right. Jack Kansky. In fact, he was a year ahead of me in Moorfields.
Mm-hmm.
The people that we sort of trained up were nearly all the consultants at Stoke Mandeville now.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, they weren't part of our.
Did you lecture much in the region?
Yes, regularly, because we have regional days.
Right.
And it was one of my missions to try and get them to organize their diabetic And you remember Charles Fox?
Yes, I do.
Who was very active. Yes. And he used to get me to talk to Northampton.
Yes.
A lot. But Northampton was also part of the
region. It was, yeah, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And how much private work were you doing?
I was doing... initially, I didn't do any.
Right.
And I, my accountant persuaded me to have a room in the house,
so that right.
I could claim that that was
right. I know.
But I didn't do any. I think for 5 years I didn't do any. So, but then gradually the more demand.
Mm. Or did somebody retire?
No. There was the demand increase.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't share rooms with Philip Audrey and Arnold Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
So I did two or three half days. I did 2 half days.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I can't remember, it was Saturday morning and one of the other days.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And then the operations.
The operation, I did them in the Acklen.
Yes.
And
that was all well kitted up.
Well, no, the Acklen. I mean, I was very, at times, very disenchanted with them because they didn't have the sort of equipment that one need. I had some had to bring them from the eye hospital.
Right.
Eventually, I persuaded them when they saw that there is a potential for them to earn some money.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no nurses trained in eyes. And,
mm-hmm.
One nurse who worked a lot was Holton, mm-hmm. who was Philip's predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
She was very cross with me because I point out things that she had to do which she wasn't doing. She said, "Oh, it's good enough for Mr. Holton, but it's not good enough for you."
That's progress, isn't it?
Yes. And so they act, but of course, as one stays in the place long enough, people get to know you, or they want to come to you, and so it in a way, I mean, I'm not saying this out of the right word to choose, but I didn't want to make a virtue of it. To some extent, the private practice bit was sort of push on to me because
mm-hmm.
particularly the people in the university, they came and they had insurance, the colleges mm-hmm. insured, they want the service, and I'm there as a clinician, I provided mm-hmm. the service.
Mm-hmm. And so to come back to the initial bit,
yes.
The annual meetings,
yes.
Were you involved with those? You must have been.
Well, yes, I was regional advisor
right.
for 5 years,
mm-hmm.
and I was college representative for the region for longer than that. And so I was involved with the regional meetings.
Yes, I was really thinking of the national meetings. The Oxford.
Oh yes, 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 yes. Oh yes, yes. I mean, if I had a paper to give, then because mm-hmm. when I was doing during the randomized control study on diabetic retinopathy, where almost every meeting
yes.
I presented a paper.
Good.
And also when I was doing the randomized control trial on cataract surgery, there was a lot to talk about.
Yes.
So and also other people asked me to.
Yes.
So both the we had two national meetings. One is the college meeting, or rather the OSUK before the college was
right.
established, the Ophthalmological Society of the United Kingdom.
Right.
So that was an annual, and that moved And then in the summer, there's the Oxford Congress. And from time to time, I gave papers there.
Were you the master of it?
No, I was the deputy master.
Right.
Well, they only chose masters from amongst council.
Right.
And Tony was already the council member, so I was deputy master for 1 year. So
when you were going to America, that was mostly on the retinopathy, was it?
No, it was mostly on the
cataract?
Lens implant.
Oh, yes, right, yes.
Lens implantation.
Yes. Yes. For cataract.
Yes, for cataract, right. Yes.
And did you keep that up? I mean...
Well, I didn't, because when lens implantation became mainstream, there wasn't, and it was largely overtaken by the Americans.
Right.
Then also later it became commercialized, and so I didn't go. There was I wasn't doing any innovative work, so I didn't. I stopped going. But it was a very interesting experience, because in England, as you know, the concept of lens implantation was started by a man called Harold Ridley in England.
Mm-hmm.
He was at St. Thomas's, and apparently a student said to him, "Look, so you remove a lens from an eye doing cataract surgery, why don't you put one back in?"
Yes.
And he thought about this and developed a lens which was very heavy, but by a great stroke of luck, the first two cases worked.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, there were all sorts of complications, mm-hmm. which he never really admitted to.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole thing went into sort of, became quiet. And
mm-hmm.
and also later attempts led to all sorts of complications. Until a man in Holland published a whole series of cases, more or less honestly, which show that if you did it in a certain way, the complications were, quote, acceptable, unquote. And then people took a great deal of interest.
Mm.
But Harold Ridley's disciple was a chap called Peter Choice, who was, for want of a better word, a man very economical with the truth.
Yeah.
And because of that, mainstream surgeons had gone off a lens implantation, and therefore it wasn't done for decades.
Right, right.
Until this Binkhorst published its result in, I think, 76.
Uh-huh.
But then, you see, Peter Choice went to America and persuaded the Americans, because of the commercial angle, he could do this and they should do that. And for years, the Americans were copying him, and there was a whole load of disasters. And so this is what led up to the necessity to do a randomized controlled trial.
Right, right.
And also, to have studies, have sort of protocols and follow-ups but then, like things in America, things evolve very quickly. Then the commercial lobby took over. It became very commercialized. And
so. Were you writing papers up to your retirement, or did you stop for a bit?
I stopped, I'm afraid.
Why not? Yes.
Because basically I ran out of things to say. I didn't.
Right.
But
not things to do. But when would your last paper have been, would you say, Hung, at a guess?
Well, it was, I tell you, it had my name on it. I contributed to the whole thing. It was, again, a cataract study in Southeast Asia.
Right.
I helped a Norwegian who got a big grant from the Foreign Office, Norwegian Foreign Office, mm-hmm. and he was at Tromsø University. He did a PhD thesis, which is sort of a continuation of this work I was... I took my protocol for the...
yes, the old protocol,
And he modified it, and then I, you know, got involved with his work, and I visited the places where he had studies to prevent blindness prevention studies in Nepal, Bangladesh, and India. So I got... I wasn't a prime mover, but, you know, I helped him.
Right. No, and so indeed.
I think it was in the early 90s.
Did you go to India or other places much?
Well, I ran a workshop in Chittagong and also in Kathmandu. And so I used to go from time to time. But India was I don't know if you know India.
I do, okay.
India is a very taxing experience.
Yes.
Well, it needed to be tough.
I always enjoyed it, mind you, but I know what you mean. Yes. I know what you mean. Are you glad you came to Oxford?
Oh, hugely, because people ask me, why don't you, if you like France so much, why don't you go and live in France?
Yeah.
I said, well, I like France a lot, but I also like Oxford better.
Yes. Now, is there something I should have asked you that I haven't?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, we've gone over the what I did, what I was involved in the eye hospital. The sort of number of changes. I don't think so, unless you could think of anything.
No, I haven't. I've run out. Yes. So should I stop then?
Yes.
That was lovely. Thank you very much, Hong. That's terrific.